Another wonderful installment of Book Corner. Tony Basilio, happy and proud and blessed today to be joined by Art Garner, author of Black Noon, The Year They Stopped the Indy 500. Bobby Unser on the cover says, this is one of the best racing books I've read. I'd recommend it for everyone from the racing historian to the casual sports fan. And Art Garner, let me, as I welcome you to Book Corner today, plead, and I'm going to throw myself on the mercy of the court. I am not a huge racing fan. I picked your book up because it looked interesting. And as I welcome you to Book Corner, I say to you, congratulations, because you did not disappoint. I was not able to put it down. Job well done.
Well, thank you very much, Tony. I appreciate that. In writing the book, I tried to write it so people who weren't big race fans would still appreciate it and still enjoy it. And it's good to hear you say that.
Well, and the other thing that you did, which I find with any great book that I pick up, is you were able to put me right in the story. And the story is such an interesting one. Let me ask you, before we talk about the tragedy that befell the Indy 500 in 1964 and why it will always be remembered for the annals of the great American race for that reason, did you realize before you started this work that there was such a compelling backstory to it, Art?
No, not at all. And that's what attracted me to the story. I was actually working on something else, a little story about Fireball Roberts, who was a NASCAR driver. And he happened to mention the name Dave McDonald, who I remembered vaguely from my youth. I became a race fan in 66, so this story really happened before I was a fan. And everything I read about it was kind of new and interesting to me. And the more I read, the more the backstory became apparent. And the coincidences and the interaction between McDonald and Sass, the two drivers who were killed in the race, was just amazing to me every step of the way. And the stories of Bobby Unser and Johnny Rutherford, who were just starting out, you know, in 64, but would go on to win six Indy 500s between them, just amazing stories to me. So that's really what led me to it.
And the entire book is such that it just builds. You have these characters in here, and we get to know the characters. We get to know them along the way. As you were developing these characters, did it surprise you they had such interesting backgrounds?
You know, I knew the history of A.J. Foyt, so not so much Foyt, but some of the other ones for sure, and some of the lesser-known drivers, like a Mastin Gregory, who doesn't even qualify for the race, but so epitomizes the era of the driver taking risks, many times don't even wear seatbelts. So it was just a different era. And I tried to capture that and try to tell about that era through the stories of the drivers. Bobby Unser doesn't have enough money to get from Albuquerque to Indianapolis for his first rookie test. So Pernelli Jones arranges for $1,000 to be sent to him, and then for a basement for him to sleep in at some neighbor's house so he has some place to stay. I don't think today's fans realize that's the way it was back in the 50s and the 60s. And that era today gets overlooked. And I think that's something that really has amazed a lot of people who've read the book.
Yeah, and I'll tell you another thing that stood out to me is how huge this race was to the American sports fan, to the American psyche. And at the time this crash happened, this race was as big as it got on the racing calendar, right, in this country?
Without a doubt. You know, there were over 250,000 people in the stands. Another million or so watching on closed circuit, which was the first time the race had ever been showed or broadcast on television or closed circuit. And, you know, 100 million people listening to the race around the world on the Armed Forces Network. So this was the biggest sporting event of the year by far in the United States. More people went to the Speedway that month of May than went to baseball games at most cities in the country. It was just the biggest event of the year.
I'll tell you what really got me about this story, and I'd like you to unpack this some for me, is that McDonald is a guy who was a risk taker on the racetrack. That's who he was, and that's how he lived. And you build his character and what's coming here, and you can just kind of see it coming slowly down the track. I mean, from the feelings his father had and premonitions people had around him to you really identified with him there at the end. And I couldn't put the book down. I knew how it ended. You knew how it ended when you wrote it. But yet, there's something about his story that's really compelling, isn't it?
And that's what attracted me to the story and really got me to finish the book was Dave McDonald. I knew Eddie Sachs. Race fans in the 60s know Eddie Sachs. He was an outgoing, gregarious, well-liked, a fan favorite. Most people know a little bit about Eddie Sachs if they were following racing in the 60s. Dave McDonald was a young, up-and-coming road racer from the West Coast who a lot of people didn't know of. I had heard the name, and I'm a pretty big race fan, and I had heard the name but really didn't know his story. And the more I researched him and found out about him, the more I became interested in telling that story. And then I had an opportunity to interview his widow, Sarah McDonald, and she had never talked about the race. But finally, talking with her son, she finally agreed to, yeah, it was time to tell the story, their story. And she just opened up for a couple of very emotional days of interviews. And afterwards, that's when I felt like, I've got to tell this story. And if she can go through that, I can do this book. And that's really what Dave McDonald's story comes from, was from Sherry and her talking with me.
And the stuff she tells you, it's almost like it's so fresh to her, right? I mean, that's what you conveyed to the reader, is that it was so fresh to her as she was recounting the story.
Literally, she had never talked about it with anybody and finally agreed that it was time to tell that story and just opened up from her heart. And she also had archives of Dave's racing career. She had probably a dozen binders full of historical papers and articles that trace his history back to when he started racing. So it's just a wealth of information. And she did have a very good memory of Dave's career. She'd taken notes almost every day on a diary about that month of May. So it was really revisiting it for the first time. So it was really fresh in her mind. It added so much to the story.
So Dave McDonald, a guy from California, he's a young up-and-coming racer, as you talked about, sort of a road king. That was an era of racing where you would build it, bring it, and race it, and it was a lot more open. It was a lot less technical. There were still cars that were powered from the rear, from the front, from different ways, and there was this clash, wasn't there, over which engineering was best. Some of the European cars were just coming into it. Besides the deaths, that race was an incredible story for all those reasons, right?
And that's some of the side stories, sidebars that really interested me as well. You've got the front engine cars, the roadsters, the dinosaurs, versus the new rear engine funny cars that are just coming into the sport. The Ford engines are making their second appearance. You've got the European drivers like Jimmy Clark and then Dan Gurney, who was driving in Formula One at the time. Driving for Lotus. There were so many other sidebars and side stories. Not to get too technical, but you have the whole gasoline-powered versus methanol power and the differences that brought to the sport and different tire manufacturers for the first time. So there are so many sidebars that make the story more interesting than just the story about the crash.
In fact, these stories at the end of the day, I don't want to say they complement the crash, but they really kind of do complement the crash, don't they?
They help explain how it might happen. You've got different fuels. You've got an era where there aren't very many rules. You can build your car as light or as heavy as you want. Use any kind of fuel you want in it. As much fuel as you want and goes into the car. At least one of the cars had over 100 gallons of gasoline in the car at the time, or methanol. Nowadays, 25 is the limit. So you can see how much racing has changed. And that race does play a pivotal role in improving safety in the sport. After the race is over, there are some people who are calling for an end to the 500. Senators, Chicago Tribune, Detroit TV station are calling for an end to the 500. and really forced the emphasis on safety from that point forward. So that race also plays a pivotal role for that reason.
Let's go back to Dave McDonald for a second and ultimately what ends up occurring. Why were, when you did your research, you dug up several different reasons, but ultimately, why were so many folks afraid around him, including himself, coming into this race?
Well, the car that he was driving, Mickey Thompson, a famous drag racer, had built this car and actually ran it in the 63 race. They changed the rules in the off-season and really changed the handling and characteristics of the car. Now, the team was trying to make it work. Dave was trying to make it work. And he's a young driver who'd never been to Indianapolis, had never driven an Indianapolis-style car. So he's out there trying to make this car work. And he's able to qualify. They run pretty well during the month, but not, he doesn't get enough practice in. Really, the problems start to arrive with the handling of the car. They think they have it fixed, but once they get into the race, he loses control of the car. And part of it, I think it's mainly as a result of the car itself, but it's also a result of his lack of experience at the track.
Yeah, so he has a lack of experience. He has a vehicle that I want to say, do we determine that it's too light? Was that one of the problems as well?
Well, the car was under less than 1,000 pounds. Too light, who knows? The front end is definitely causing a problem. The car lifts in the air. Now, they think they've completely rebuilt the car, completely reworked the car, and they think they have it fixed. Talking to some of the crewmen from that day, they believe that car was handling better than it handled all month long. Certainly, Dave was still a little concerned about it, but he did get in it and he drove it. You know, his father had said he was concerned about it, but that in the end, he was ready to drive it.
It's an incredible story because I mentioned earlier just the feeling of dread as the story marches along. But somewhere within the story of dread, I was sort of holding out hope that maybe he wouldn't get in the car, or maybe cooler heads would prevail, or maybe somebody would see, hey, this isn't a good idea. This guy doesn't have enough experience to pull this off, but yet it's almost as if he knew where he was going and he did it anyway. Did you get that sense when you wrote this?
Well, he was a confident man. There's no question about it, a confident driver, as most race drivers are. They're confident in his skills and his ability. And, you know, he'd won a race just 2 weeks earlier in a car that he'd gotten in for the first time and drove, had never driven before, got in it that morning, and he drove it to a victory in a race. So he was, you know, he was a confident, incredibly talented driver. So he felt he could do it. You know, it's hard to say that he had a premonition. I don't think he did. Certainly others around him did. He was driving for Cobra and Carroll Shelby at the time. And Shelby told me he pleaded with McDonald not to drive that car. You know, his others have said the same thing, that they asked him not to drive it. Dave felt an obligation. There's no question about that. You know, Mickey Thompson had asked him to drive in Indianapolis. He has said yes. He had qualified the car, and he felt an obligation to drive that car in the race. And obviously, once the race started, he was going really fast. He passed a number of cars in just the first two laps. And then, you know, he just lost it. He got in a situation he had not been in before, passing a couple of cars, and I think that lack of experience showed through.
At the time of impact, and you talk about this in your book, and some racers didn't know whether others were bluffing in terms of how much fuel they were carrying, because some had painted a picture. Whereas before you said today everything's uniform, as we know. Back then, some guys would say, hey, our tank, we're carrying so much that we may not even have to pit. And so you had that almost peer pressure, how much fuel you were going to carry. Were you able to determine exactly how much was there in terms of the time of impact during his crash?
Yeah, he started the race with 45 gallons of fuel. So he was down a couple of gallons at that point. There were some rumors that he had over 100 gallons of fuel on board when that happened. No way. He had 45 gallons of fuel, or a gallon or two less than that, actually, at the time of impact. But that's one of the myths from the race that carried on for years and years. And I know when I first interviewed Dan Gurney and A.J. Foyt, when I asked them about McDonald's car, they both said, oh, yeah, that's the car with 100 gallons of fuel in it. But that's just not the case. there was never more than 45-gallon tank in that car.
And isn't that interesting that racers themselves that were involved in that race, guys involved in the sport, it'd be one thing for you to believe that, for a writer or two to believe that, but for those guys to believe that, what I was left with as I read the book was just the mind games that were going on behind the scenes, because truly guys didn't know how much other guys were carrying, right?
Right. That was the closest guard to secret in Gasoline Alley, was how much fuel you had on board. The days before the race, a couple of days before the race, it rained for two or three straight days. And that was kind of the game in Gasoline Alley, how much gasoline do you have? Everybody was hinting, oh, we've got 100 gallons on board. The Ford guys were saying, we can go without any stops. Or implying that, and the off-beat drivers were saying, implying they could go with just one stop. There was one car that had 100 gallons on board. He did run the entire race with only one stop and finished fourth, and Johnny White was named Rookie of the Year. Actually, one car did it, but only one car. Nobody else tried it.
My gosh, you think about, I mean, just looking back through the lens of history, how completely dangerous that is. That, as we visit today with Art Garner, Black Noon is the name of the book. The year they stopped the Indy 500, and believe me, the surface is only being scratched here, as this is a really interesting book. Whether you're a sports fan, whether you just like a little drama, whether you want to read something that is extremely well written, trust me, this is from Thomas Dunn Books, and it is extremely well done. And Art, the detail, the things you were able to come up with for the book, before we get to the crash itself, right up to Friday the 29th, when McDonald's wife, who you tell me, Sherry, who you interviewed for the first time in this book, she opens up about it, she arrives in a bright green dress. And even that, at the time, was a no-no. Expound on that.
They came from a road racing background and weren't aware of the traditions of Indianapolis, one of which says you don't wear green to the track. You just do not wear green. And she arrives at the airport, and Dave picks her up in this dress that he has picked off for her to wear that first day at the track, and it's bright green. And they're with McDonald's teammate, who his wife whispers to Sherry that you can't wear that to the track. You can't wear green. That's unlucky. And Dave says, that's nonsense. We're going to the racetrack. And she still blames herself at least a small bit for wearing that green dress for what happened. She knows it's silly, but she still has that feeling in the back of her mind.
Isn't that remarkable? Where did you get that?
She told me. I was not aware of the green dress story when I started doing the interview, but she brought it up, and then she discussed it. I knew about the unlucky green color, but I did not know that she had had that green dress on when she arrived, and she just told me the story. One of those things that just gives you chills while you're sitting there and she's talking about it.
Yeah, it gives me chills hearing you talk about it, and it gave me chills to read it, because the whole time I'm sitting there thinking, look, I know how the story's going to end, and it's not going to end well. And as you get back towards the back part of the book, and this you had this on page 203, as you get through the book, you start to think, man, there were people around him telling him not to race. He calls his father and says, you know, I really don't feel good about this, but I'm going to do it anyway because I'm a racer. I'm a wheel man. This is what we do. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to do my best. His wife shows up in a green dress. She says, hey, I've got to go change this thing. This is bad luck. And the whole time, this McDonald guy is fearless. He's going, no, don't worry about that. We don't care about some silly superstition. Let's get to the racetrack. Whereas I'm looking at it and I'm going, hey, the pieces to the puzzle are adding up here, man. Don't go out there.
Yeah, it's easy in hindsight, and especially in writing a book, to put all these pieces together. There is indication that Dave was concerned, but he just said he had the skills to overcome that, I believe.
Let's talk about race day itself. Were there things ordinary that day leading up to the crash, or was it just another garden variety 500 to that point?
There had been a lot of things leading up to the crash. Record speed all month long had really perked the interest of the fans. In fact, on qualifying, when the record speeds were set by these new Ford Lotus cars, they'd had a record crowd for qualifying. They'd had closed the infield for the first time ever to vehicle traffic. There were just that many people there. So there had been a lot of interest throughout the month building over the increasing speed. Speeds were up almost 10 miles an hour over the previous year. For race fans, there's not a bigger or better draw than increased speed. So there's a lot of anticipation on that. You had Jimmy Clark, the world champion, on the pole. A.J. Foyt and Parnelli Jones, the dinosaurs, they call them, driving the Roadsters back in the second row. Could be the last race ever for the Roadsters. There's a lot of things that were driving that interest in the race. You know, and probably Dave McDonald and the Thompson car was overlooked by most. He was in the field, I think he's starting 14th or something like that. I don't remember exactly. There were a lot of things that had drawn the attention of the racing fans to this race.
You know, another thing that you point out in the book that I love is the relationship between Jim Murray and Eddie Sachs. And Jim Murray, typical member of the, what I would say, sports media, the non-racing watching media. There's always been a sense, they're adversarial, I think, toward any form of racing. They don't get it. They don't understand it, especially in a lot of the big towns. And Jim Murray, who's a Hall of Fame sports writer, a guy whose work I enjoyed through the years. But it's interesting how Eddie Sachs, with his personality, was able to draw him in. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, you know, like I say, Eddie Sachs is an outgoing, gregarious, fun-loving person who fans loved. And a lot of other drivers didn't particularly like Eddie Sachs because he was so outgoing, because he was so well-liked. They saw him as something of a showboat. But Jim Murray, as you mentioned, was the L.A. Times reporter, had never been to the 500. And this was in 63 when he decided to come to the race. And Bob Thomas, who was the racing beat reporter for the Times, has to set Murray up with a driver to kind of show him around. And he approaches Roger Ward, who jokingly says, "I'll break both his legs if he comes in just my alley." So he says, "Well, Roger Ward's probably not the right guy." And then he goes and finds Eddie Sachs. And Eddie says, "Sure, I'll spend some time with him." And Eddie Sachs goes on to spend the entire day with Jim Murray, show him around the track, show him Gasoline Alley, trying to tell him what racing meant to him. And Murray falls in love with the guy. And so, yeah, it tells the story of Eddie Sachs, a prince at home, how he referred to Eddie Sachs as, who was known as the crown prince of racing at the time. Yeah, Jim Murray just falls in love with Eddie Sachs. Murray is not at the race in 64. He's actually watching it on TV. And there's a pretty poignant point in the book where Murray says, "Oh, please, don't let it be Eddie." And of course it is. It involves an accident.
Yeah, you point out that Jim Murray's there at the LA Sports Arena along with a packed audience. And you said before, just so people understand the scope of this thing, it was watched by how many folks in arenas throughout the country? This is not ABC television like we're used to now. This is closed circuit. You have to buy a ticket, go to a local venue. How many folks saw it that way?
About 1 million people in the United States.
That is wow, that's huge. And then how many folks heard it on the radio? Which this is an incredible, when you factor in armed forces, how many folks?
Over 100 million. You know, and that's the way it was back then. In that era, that's the way it was. And I kind of start the book in 63, recounting the 63 race and how people went to Memorial Day. They listened to the Indy 500 in the morning or in the early afternoon, and then they barbecued in the afternoon. That was Memorial Day. And then in 64 was the first closed circuit broadcast. Jim Murray is at the sports arena in L.A., as is Dave McDonald's father. Dave McDonald's brother and Dave McDonald's son are all there together at the sports arena as well.
As we're visiting today on Book Corner, a special guest is Art Garner. Black Noon, the year they stopped the Indy 500. And you know, Art, the one thing that is interesting, and you brought it up earlier, is that Fireball Roberts here in East Tennessee, I'm in the middle of NASCAR country. Fireball Roberts is a household name in these parts, a Hall of Fame racer. But he plays a role in this. Talk about that.
He sure does, and as mentioned earlier, that's what attracted me to the story. That's how I first got onto the story. Fireball and Dave McDonald are paired by Carroll Shelby in a Cobra for the 12 Hours of Sebring in 1963. Actually, they fall out early, and the car breaks early, so they're out of the race. But they become good friends, and Dave starts running some stock car races, and Fireball serves as kind of a mentor for him in those stock car races. Fireball has his accident in the middle of May of 64, when he crashes into Charlotte and is badly burned, just 2 weeks earlier, prior to when Dave has his accident and is killed in a crash. And one of the side stories that Sherry McDonald told me was how when Fireball was injured and badly burned, their children wrote letters to Fireball, goodwill letters, that same day. And Dave said, well, wait till I get home. Maybe I can go to Charlotte and take them to him and deliver them in person. Now, of course, Dave is killed before that ever happens. And when I was interviewing Sherry, she had the actual original letters still in her possession in these notebooks that she has of Dave's history.
Art, this is your first book, and you did an incredible job with it. I mean, did you feel like a lottery winner when she was opening up that treasure trove to you of all that racing history? What an incredible story.
I felt a tremendous responsibility at that point. At this point, I'm still doing research, and I'm writing, and I think it's a good story. And she opens up, and I just said, that's when I felt like I have to tell this story. I said, I have to go home and tell my wife I have to quit my job so I can finish this book, too. So I knew that was going to be a challenge. But really, when she was opening up, I was just so more and more responsible to tell the story.
Okay, so the crash itself, for those that may or may not open the book, it is fiery. It is absolutely a shot heard around the world. What exactly can we ascertain through the lens of time happened in the wreck?
Well, certainly Dave McDonald is running very fast, running very well. He comes up on a couple of drivers, Jim Herterbees, who I think a lot of people will remember that name, and Walt Hanskin. And he goes to pass those two just as Hanskin goes to pass Herterbees. So he has to swerve again, and the wind catches his car. He loses control, and Dave spins to the inside of the track, slams into the inside wall, bursts into flames, and slides back across the track where Eddie Sachs is leading a freight train of about four cars that include Johnny Rutherford, Ronnie Duman, and Bobby Unser. And those cars just plow right into Dave McDonald, unfortunately. And Eddie Sachs is killed almost immediately, and there's just a huge explosion and fire. Both Bobby Unser and Johnny Rutherford are burned. Their cars are knocked out of the race. And another driver named Ronnie Duman is also badly burned and ends up in hospital as well. But all those drivers do survive that crash.
And it's incredible the way some of these drivers recount what they saw on that day to you, and including Bobby Unser, who just, it's haunting how he says, I hate seeing dead people to you. He says, but I'm pretty sure there are deaths. He was thinking at the time, but there's nothing I can do about it. Those guys stay out there and race.
I was finishing the book when Dan Weldon was killed in Las Vegas, and they stopped that race and do not restart that race. So I started asking some of the drivers who I had not interviewed yet, you know, how did you get back in the car? Again, this is capturing the different era. And those drivers told me that they never even thought twice about it. And A.J. Foyt just gave me a look when I asked him, how did you get back in the car? He gave me a look like, that's what we did. There was never any question. Said I had to get bait. I needed to get back in that car and run that race. Dan Gurney said, we all had a World War II mentality. Figured that sooner or later we were going to get it. And nothing had changed, so we were getting back in that car. And Bobby Unser was saying, I had to get bait. His neck is burned from the crash. He scoops up some motor oil, you know, rubs it into his neck, and then goes sets off to see other car owners to see if maybe he can get a ride in their car for the race. And maybe that driver wouldn't want to restart. Like, every single driver does restart that race, and it just kind of captures that different era.
Absolutely a different era. But you know, one thing that remains the same, whenever there's a high-profile crash of this nature, and there's tragedy in auto racing, the controversy and the finger-pointing is sure to come. And in chapter 29, you talk about that with the finger pointing, the funerals, and then the issue of fuel. And you know what that kind of reminded me of is the whole layer of controversy that occurred after Dale Earnhardt died tragically at Daytona, the Hans device, what went on with his restraint, all those controversies that came out of that that helped change the sport. And this race had an equal sort of impact, didn't it? Or a similar impact?
Yes, it did. It was a pivotal race as far as a shift to the focus on safety. Minimum weight standards were established. Maximum fuel level standards were set. There were new rules written about how can you carry the fuel in your car. It had to be in a fuel cell with a still other core on it. So there were a lot of changes made to the sport at that point with an emphasis on safety. That was really a turning point in a focus on driver safety.
Art Garner, on the way out, it has been a real pleasure having you today here on Book Corner. What we'd like to do is give our authors an opportunity to have the final word. Maybe if you want to introduce something into the conversation or reiterate a point or just tie all this together for us, but please, by all means, the floor is yours.
Well, first off, let me tell all your listeners that Dave McDonald goes into the Corvette Hall of Fame later this month up in Kentucky. So if any of you fans there are interested in the Corvette Museum, I think it's in Lexington, Kentucky. Tony, I appreciate all you said about Black Noon. I did try to write it for people who weren't big fans of the sport or racing. At the same time, I wanted to be true to racing fans. So there's probably a little bit more technology than everybody needs, but I hope they appreciate that. And really, probably more than anything else, I tried to capture the lives of Dave McDonald and Eddie Sachs, tell the story of those two men, and also that era of auto racing, what it was like to race back then.
Art, you tied it all together, I think, masterfully, and I tip my cap to you. And thanks for joining us today.
Tony, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Once again, Art Garner, Black Noon, The Year They Stopped the Indy 500, available from Thomas Dunn Books. You'll be glad you picked it up. And thanks once again to Art Garner, Black Noon, The Year They Stopped the Indy 500.